Welcome to the Talk the Walk Sports Podcast. You're going to walk the talk and talk the walk. You're going to walk the talk and talk the walk. You're going to walk the talk and talk. My brothers and my sisters. Now, here's your host, Jason Walker.
All right, welcome everybody to the Talk the Walk Sports Podcast presented by PowerRankingsAndMore.com and Aggie Radio. Thank you so much for listening. We've got a lot to go over today. We're going to spend a lot of time in the NFL, and we're also going to hit a little bit of NBA as it's coming back, and we're going to spend a lot more time in the NBA in the coming weeks as the preseason and regular season begins to unfold. But we are right in the heat of the NFL. We're getting into week 5. We've already had a game played. The Patriots defeated the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, and the MVP of that game was Nick Folk, at least for the Patriots, as Nick Folk missed 3 field goals. And I remember watching that game. Being a Patriots fan, I, of course, laughed and was happy that he missed those field goals. But, of course, Tampa Bay's kicking woes are not nearly done. They thought they were after they signed Nick Folk, who is a decent kicker. But anyway, we're going to get on. We're going to talk about Cam Newton and the fallout after his unfortunate comments. We're going to talk about how to know if your NFL team, or really any NFL team, is a pretender rather than a contender this early in the season. And then, like I said, we'll get into the NBA's. There was a survey of GMs they do every year, and that came out. And we're going to talk about some of the things I felt they may not have gotten quite right in their voting. So, without further ado, let's get into the NFL and Cam Newton.
NFL.
Touchdown, Titans! It's a miracle!
Pass is intercepted at the goal line by Malcolm Butler.
Throws into the end zone. Touchdown! Touchdown!
All right, so for those who are unaware of what happened this past Wednesday during the Wednesday press conferences that are held by pretty much every NFL team, Cam Newton was asked a question from a female reporter regarding Cam Newton's teammate and wide receiver Devin Funchess. Hoping I said that right. Newton then replied, before actually answering the question, he said that it was funny, and that was the word he used, it was funny to hear a reporter talk about running routes, which was the subject matter of the question. And that, of course, did not go over well with any of the social media voices, I guess. Let's just say that Cam Newton was criticized by anybody and everybody who decided to have a public voice. There's only really one person I found who kind of stuck up for Cam Newton in any way, because everybody wanted to be politically correct and say that Cam Newton was completely off his rocker. This was completely uncalled for. It was absolutely and 100% sexist, and Cam Newton needs to repent of his ways and move on. And it bugs me because I listened to the comment, and I didn't think, oh, Cam Newton's sexist. That's just stupid. I've heard sexist. I've heard racist. That was not overtly sexist. Was it uncalled for? Yeah. Should Cam Newton have held his tongue? Yes. There are things you need to learn when you grow up. Things you learn not to say. Because, yeah, a lot of people will think that. It's funny to hear a female talk about sports in detail. You might hear, like, there's, like, a sideline reporter who's going in-depth on this, perhaps one player. Maybe it's a female color commentator, of which I've heard very few. And we're going to get to that in a moment about female color commentators and the like. But somebody on the couch might say, it sounds kind of funny. The girl is talking about sports like that. And all his buddies on the couch and in the room would be like, yeah, it kind of is. And the females in the room, if there were any, would agree. It's not common for women to be knowledgeable and have in-depth opinions on sports. I'm not saying it's not possible. In fact, there's a girl in my apartment complex. She knows sports. I've talked with her a little bit. I got to meet her on one occasion, and she knows her sports, and I could have a legitimate sports conversation with her. I'm not saying women can't have opinions on sports and can't root for their teams or their players or do anything that men can do in terms of rooting for sports. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is it's less common. And that's essentially what Cam Newton was trying to say, or at least trying to get across. He was probably just trying to be a little bit cute with his comment. Because he wasn't necessarily wrong. But again, he really should have held his tongue. There are some things that you just need to learn not to say. As an NFL player, you will be held to a higher standard. But people just need to friggin' calm the heck down. It's just ridiculous how much hate he got. And listening, I happened to leave on the Thursday night game after it was finished. I usually just turn it off or leave the room. But I was listening to some post game, and there was the three guys. I can't remember all their names. I know Deion Sanders was one of them. And he was the voice of reason saying that we should all move on from this now that Cam has issued an apology. But the other two were all like going in depth and saying, yeah, he needs to mature and he needs to prove that he's not sexist. Just come on, people. It was a stupid comment. He shouldn't have said it. It sounded sexist. That's the way people took it. I don't know if it was or not. I'm not Cam Newton, so I don't know if he was trying to be sexist. So let's just take it for what it was. It was a dumb comment by a guy who's known to be a little immature at times. And let's just forget about it. We forget other people's mistakes. We forgot Michael Vick's mistakes for the most part, except those who, I don't know, hate Michael Vick. Because he went on, I guess you could say, repented of his sins, or however you want to phrase that. But the thing is that I find it extremely hypocritical of places like ESPN, Fox, CBS, or any other sports network to be decrying Cam's comment, because they are a major part of the problem. The reason that it is funny, so to speak, for a woman to discuss sports in detail is because all of the talking heads and most of the reporters we see are male. And guess who hires them? ESPN, Fox, CBS, all of the sports websites, and whoever else is doing sports. They are the ones who do the hiring, and they're the ones who are hiring all the men. So I'm not saying it's overtly their fault, because sometimes if you're dealing with a pool that's, throw out a number, 70% men, I don't know what the real proportion is, but say it's 70% men, then you're going to end up with probably at least 70% of men in your company, if that's the pool you're hiring from. But I can't think of really more than one female who is a major part of a sports talk show, and it's Jemele Hill. Or Jemele Hill. I haven't heard her name out loud. I've just seen it written down because I don't listen to her show. I don't really listen to any of the ESPN shows, but she's a co-host on SportsCenter, one of the SportsCenter shows. And she's the only person who I know of who has a major role as a host or a co-host. She actually gets to be one of the talking heads on one of the talking head shows. All of the others that I can see, all of these, you know, Sunday NFL Countdown, Fox Sunday Morning Talking Head thing, whatever their name is called, all the different things that people have for their shows, there's maybe one woman. And that woman is usually younger, more attractive, white, typically blonde, and is just there for eye candy and to introduce the topics, close out the show, open up the show, whatever. That's all they do. And one recent example of this that really got me, it made me roll my eyes. I didn't think about it too much, although it's been on my mind recently considering these comments, is that I believe it was during a college football game, I saw this little banner ad kind of down at the bottom. There were, ESPN was advertising its new host for their NFL Sunday Countdown show. It's NFL Sunday Countdown or Sunday NFL Countdown, however they word it. So it was Sam Ponder, and she was front and center, and I can get that. They were advertising it. Part of the advertisement was that she was the new host. She's a new member of the crew. But the thing that bugged me was that she was completely front and center. She was, you could barely see the guys in the background, you know, the five or six guys, mind you. Again, if we're talking about sexism here. And Sam Ponder was not exactly dressed in the most modest fashion. She wasn't wearing anything scandalous. It's not like she was sitting there wearing a bikini. But she wasn't exactly covering up her entire body either. She was a little revealing. And she was there essentially to be eye candy for the ad. And I feel like so many times that's just what these people are. For sideline reporters, for hosts, for anything where you see a woman, they're just half the reason they're there is for eye candy. And that's the feeling that I get, because I don't see reporters when I look at the picture of the guy who writes the article on whatever website I'm reading. It's a guy. The play-by-play commentators, they're guys. The color commentator, the guy. It's always guys. The only time you see women is when they're doing women's sports. So for ESPN and all these other sites to be criticizing Cam Newton for being supposedly sexist, well, just because Cam's saying, well, it's weird to see a female reporter. I don't see very many of those. Well, you guys are part of the problem. You're the guys who are only hiring male reporters. And those are the role models that we see as the public. You know, we may not see the undercover journalists, the guys who maybe we don't see their articles. Maybe they're on like a wire service, or, you know, they don't always get their name slapped on top of their article. We don't get to see them as role models. We see, you know, all the color commentators, the talking heads and all that. We see them as the sports personalities, the sports journalists. These are the guys that we look to for our sports knowledge, you know, when we're growing up. And when people decide they want to be sports journalists like I did, well, who do they think of when they think of sports journalists? Well, they think of all the guys that they've seen on all these big networks. I don't think of any women journalists because I haven't seen very many. I think there was one I remember in the newspaper growing up, and I can't even remember her name. And she was one of like seven sports reporters that I was aware of for that newspaper. So, again, you know, the whole thing with Cam Newton, it's just a complete mess. Nobody's coming out of this looking good. People might think they've won a victory for social justice, but really they've made themselves look like idiots, and they've crucified a guy who really made an innocent mistake. It's like crucifying a guy for stealing a penny. He made a stupid comment, let's move on, and well, the big networks who are trying to act all social justice-y, try and look inward and see that they are the problem instead of these athletes who are just making a stupid comment. So, that's enough about Cam Newton. We're going to actually talk about real sports instead of the stuff that happens between the games. We're going to talk about how to know if your NFL team is a pretender, or if you want to know if any of these other teams are a pretender. Because let's look at this. You know, every time or every season around this time of the season, you know, we're going into week five, that stretch between like week three and week six, we're like, all right, who are the contenders and who are the pretenders? Like, that's the biggest phrase that you'll see from week three to week six in these, you know, summary articles and looking ahead to the games to come. But instead of just telling you who I think the contenders and the pretenders are, I'm going to tell you why I think the way I do. I'm going to teach you how to do it yourself. And I'm going to use some of last year's pretenders as examples of what a pretender tends to look like. Now, it's not a perfect formula because all teams tend to be different, and not all teams that from this season fit the formula. But you'll see there are some definite trends among pretenders. So, last year, like I said, there were four pretenders, and through week four, these teams were a combined 14-1. 14 wins and one loss. You had the Denver Broncos, who were 4-0. The Philadelphia Eagles were 3-0. They had a week four bye. The Baltimore Ravens were 3-1, and the Minnesota Vikings were 4-0. Two of those, the Broncos and the Vikings, would go on to be 5-0. The Vikings did. I can't remember if the Broncos did. They might have lost the next game. But let's look at all the things they have in common. They have four things that they generally have in common, and we're going to use this to create a bit of an example and almost a formula, a model, if you will. So first off, they're in the bottom half of the league on offense. None of those four teams was in the top half of the league on offense. The average rank was 23rd. So they're not really like in the bottom five. None of them were in the bottom five. But most of them are in that 20 to 25 range, or more like 18 to 25. They're close to the middle, but they're on the wrong side of the 16 mark, which is right there smack in the middle. And here's one that may surprise you. All of them had great defenses. All of them were above average. The lowest ranked defense was 13th. The average rank was 7th. And there were a couple of top five. So all four of these teams had good defenses. You remember the Denver Broncos last year and the Minnesota Vikings had a really good reputation for having an excellent defense. They were shut down defenses. Yet they were pretenders. And that's a major point. Now, third, average to below average quarterback play. None of these guys had overtly bad quarterbacks. In fact, all of them were fairly decent. You had Trevor Siemian, Carson Wentz, Joe Flacco, and Sam Bradford. I'd be willing to start most of those guys in most circumstances. Might be a little iffy on Siemian, but most of those guys are guys that you can count on. In fact, Carson Wentz, you know, he's a rookie. So you can almost forgive his average to below average play because he was a rookie and he didn't have very many weapons. I mean, the average total QBR rank of all these starting quarterbacks was 21st. The highest was 17th. So you're getting close to average. That's like right below average. You're like right on the line. But still, below average. Now, this fourth one, there's an inability to run the ball effectively. Now, there is a bit of an exception in this case because the Eagles were 11th in total rushing yards, although I will say they were 18th in yards per carry. So while they had more yards, they were less efficient. They were below average in their efficiency. But the Broncos, Ravens, and Vikings were all in the bottom five in total rushing yards, and they were all in the bottom 10 in yards per carry. So these four things, bottom half of the league in offense, top-tier defense, average to below average QB play, and an inability to run the ball with efficiency or at all for most of them. So these are the things that you'll see, and that's the thing with pretenders is that you see them so often, like you combine all these things, you see a team that is carried by perhaps a particular part of their team. In this case with the Vikings, they were carried by their defense. The Broncos have been coasting on their defense in non-Peyton Manning years for quite a while. You remember Tim Tebow? He was carried by his defense, and they were able to fluke their way in the end of the season and get into the playoffs, win a playoff game, but ultimately their pretenders got killed like 45-10 by the Patriots. They were never contenders. But some of these teams, when they have a lot of these aspects, they're able to maybe cheat their way around a little bit. And then when they finally face the real tests, they get exposed. When they face the full 16 games, maybe they can squeeze through four games and win three or four of those four games. But they can't face the full 16-game season that real contenders will be able to push through and get, you know, somewhere between 10 and 14 wins usually. So let's look at, I've got, I believe, seven teams on the docket here that we're going to go through and examine how they fit into each of these four categories. And they're not in any particular order. I didn't organize them by whether or not I thought they were contenders or pretenders. I just have the numbers up here, and we're going to see. So first off, we have the Buffalo Bills. This team is leading the AFC East. They are 3-1. And you think, you know, I thought at the beginning of the season they were just going to tank. Well, suddenly they're getting up there in wins, and obviously they're leading the AFC East. They're in the playoff picture for now, but are they contenders? Are they pretenders? Well, 29th in offense. What's the first indicator? Bottom half of the league on offense. Second one, top-tier defense. The Bills are 8th in defense, and I believe they're first in points against. Yes, first in points against. Tyrod Taylor, he's 29th in yards per game, average to below average. He's currently actually 9th in total QBR, which puts him more towards the average. And he's got a 65% completion percentage. So there's some mixed things there. He's not necessarily producing the yards, but he's actually being fairly efficient. He's got a good total QBR and a good completion percentage. So average to maybe slightly above average, especially for Tyrod Taylor. Now, they're 16th in rushing yards, although there's a huge drop-off. Their average in total rushing yards, they're 27th in yards per carry. So, average, very below average in terms of rushing offense. So, the Bills, verdict, probably a pretender. They're not likely going to make it through a 16-game season and pull off this same 3-1 pace. They're not going 12-4. I think that's the pace the 3-1 start is on. Let's move on to the second one, the Philadelphia Eagles. These guys, I believe, were my dark horse pick to win the NFC East, and I believe they're actually in the lead for the NFC East. And let's look at how they fit in. They're third in offense, so they're backwards. They don't fit number one. Top-tier defense? Not so much. They're 24th in defense, so they're actually struggling defensively, which is something that could hurt them later. He's 7th in total QBR. He has a below average completion percentage at 60%, but he's 11th in total yards per game. So there's a little bit of an efficiency concern, but overall, he's playing above average and he's, you know, on the top half. And the Eagles are 3rd in rushing yards, 5th in yards per carry. So they do not fit any of the criteria for a pretender. I would say the Eagles are more contender than pretender. Are they Super Bowl contenders? We'll see, especially with that defense. The Denver Broncos, 13th in offense, so they're slightly above average. They're not in the bottom half, so they don't fit in the first category of a below average offense. They do, however, fit the first in defense. They've allowed the least amount of yards, so they do fit that top tier defense. Trevor Siemian, below average, 23rd in total QBR, 7-4 touchdown to interception ratio, 18th in total passing yards per game. But here's where it gets crazier. They're 3rd in rushing yards, 11th in yards per carry, so decidedly above average in rushing. So here with the Broncos, we're getting severe mixed signals. We don't really know what we're going to see, and it'll really depend on how Trevor Siemian does and if this running game can hold up. CJ Anderson's a good running back, but he got injured last year, and he's never really had a history of putting up big numbers. So it's really going to depend on that offense, because last year the Broncos were one of the pretenders because their offense was bad. This year their offense has been serviceable, and so far it's led them to be 3-1, although they lost to the Bills. But again, the Bills are 3-1 as well, so who knows? So with the Broncos, verdict is, well, who knows? We're going to have to wait and see. I'm sorry that I can't give you a decided verdict on that. I would say I would lean more pretender in terms of they won't win a Super Bowl, but more contender in the sense that they have a chance to make the playoffs. This is a good team. Trevor Siemian's, you know, a year further into his NFL career in terms of starting, and CJ Anderson, if he stays healthy, can be a good workhorse back for them. Moving on to number four, the Los Angeles Rams. They are also leading their division. Surprisingly, everybody was throwing Jared Goff out with the bathwater, but I wasn't the only person to say this, but Jared Goff, I felt, was going to improve because he was going to be in a better offensive system. They gave him some more weapons, and he's another year into his NFL career. And so far, everything seems to be paying off. They're fifth in offense, first in points. The Rams are. So they don't fit the first category of being a pretender. They're 27th in defense, which may come back to haunt them in terms of actually going somewhere in the playoffs. So they don't fit that second category. Third, Jared Goff is 10th in QBR, 66.7 completion percentage, 9th in total passing yards per game. So above average. You don't need to put him in the top tiers with the Tom Brady's and Aaron Rodgers, but he's above average so far. And they are average to below average in rushing. They're 15th in total rushing yards, 21st in yards per carry. So they're certainly not above average. They're not bad, but they are below average in at least efficiency. They're above average in terms of production. The Carolina Panthers, no, I should do the verdict with the Rams. Again, I'm going to say I believe they can win the NFC West. I don't think that this is just a fluke. I think that Jared Goff, maybe he's not going to be a Tom Brady, but he could be a Phillip Rivers. He could be an Eli Manning. The good years of Joe Flacco that he had, like, he can be like the better Joe Flacco from like 5 years ago. So Jared Goff can be a good quarterback for them, and he can lead them to a division title this year, especially considering Seattle's struggles, and nobody else in that division other than Seattle is even going to threaten them. So, especially considering the Rams don't fit the mold for a pretender, I think they're going to move on and be potentially a playoff team, especially if they win the division. Fifth is the Carolina Panthers. They're 22nd in offense, and they're probably a lot better there because they were able to light up the Patriots. They'd probably be further behind if the Patriots hadn't let them roll up and down the field for tons of yards and tons of points. The Panthers are fourth in defense. Cam Newton, decidedly below average. 22nd in total QBR, 20th in total yards per game. He has a 65% completion percentage, which I believe would be a career high for him. I don't think he's ever thrown in the 60s before. He's usually in the high 50s. And the Panthers are 13th in rushing yards, 18th in yards per carry. So about average in terms of production and efficiency. So the Carolina Panthers, unfortunately, they have pretender written on them. For being 3-1, as bad as they've seemed, things are going to get worse. Maybe not as bad as last year, but the Panthers, you're not keeping up the pace. Don't plan on it. Sixth, this is one of the surprise teams of the NFL, and that we didn't expect them to be 4-0 at this point, and that's the Kansas City Chiefs. They don't fit the mold of pretender at all. They're second in offense, 26th in defense. Alex Smith is 12th in QBR, 76% completion percentage. And the Chiefs are first in rushing yards and first in yards per carry. So basically, they are the reverse of my pretender model. And so this is why I think the Kansas City Chiefs, they could go to the Super Bowl. And it's really because Alex Smith is playing much better. And you might say, well, Alex Smith just has more weapons around him. Wasn't that what happened with Joe Flacco? Joe Flacco, honestly, isn't all that much better than Alex Smith. But Joe Flacco, because he had weapons around him, he had... I can't remember all their names. I mean, Dennis Pitta, the tight end. I believe he had Steve Smith, Anquan Boldin, and a couple other guys, including good running backs. And he has a unique distinction. I believe since about 2003, there have been four quarterbacks to represent the AFC in the Super Bowl. Tom Brady, Ben Roethlisberger, Peyton Manning, and Joe Flacco. Three of those guys are Hall of Famers. Joe Flacco is not a Hall of Famer, but he has joined an elite group by not just winning the Super Bowl for the AFC, but representing the AFC. The other three guys are surefire first ballot Hall of Famers. Two of them are arguably the greatest two quarterbacks in the history of the NFL. But because Joe Flacco, an average quarterback, had great weapons, he was able to go far. And that's why I believe the Kansas City Chiefs, even if you don't believe Alex Smith is an elite quarterback, he has the weapons and the offensive talent around him to essentially be carried as a quarterback and make him better and in order to help the Kansas City Chiefs not only make the playoffs, but to win playoff games and to potentially get all the way to the Super Bowl. So I say the Chiefs are a contender and not a pretender. Finally, we have the Detroit Lions, and unfortunately, they fit the mold of pretender. They're 24th in offense, 15th in defense. Matt Stafford, below average play, 14th in QBR, 19th in yards per game, 63.8 completion percentage, which is a little below average for a quarterback. They're 20th in rushing yards and 24th in yards per carry. So, pretender for them. So you're looking at the Bills, pretender. The Eagles, probably contender. Broncos, not sure. Half and half. Wait and see on Simeon. I about coughed into the mic. The Rams, lean contender. Panthers, serious pretenders. The Chiefs, serious contenders. And the Lions, pretenders, sadly. I'd like to see the Lions do well, but again, they're pretenders. So that is how you tell if your team, or any team you're curious about, is a pretender rather than a contender. You simply got to look and see, are they being carried by their defense? If they are, they're not going to go very far. Because if your defense is better than your offense, you'd better have a friggin' good defense. Like, it's seriously all-time great defense, because defenses cannot carry you through a regular season and to a championship. You must score points. People say defense wins championships, but yeah, you still need the offense. The defense will win you a championship, but the offense will put you in that championship. And frankly, I'm pretty sure it's offensive plays that have won the last five Super Bowls, with the exception of the Panthers-Broncos Super Bowl, where defense did play a deciding factor. So, again, those are your contenders and pretenders, and now you know how to tell instead of having to go through and read all the articles and say, oh, they're a contender, oh, they're a pretender. You now know yourself. The more you know, that's what you learn here on Talk the Walk. All right, now we're going to get into the NBA. We're going to talk about the GM survey and the three things in that survey that I believe they didn't get quite right. So let's hit it with the NBA.
NBA.
Back to the below, right shot, here we go.
All right, so the NBA General Manager Survey. I mean, they do this pretty much every year. They go through a whole host of topics like who's going to win MVP, who will win the championship, breakout players, most improved. Basically, it's kind of like the NBA awards with a few questions added. They ask, like, who's the best player at every single position, and we'll get into one of those. But I'm going to talk about three things that I felt they didn't get quite right, either who should be at the top, or who should be close to the top, or just I'll rant a little bit about one of the players for you. I'm sure you can enjoy that. But first, who will win the MVP? This is a predictive thing, and they predicted LeBron James. 50% of them picked LeBron James. And if this question was worded, who should win MVP, I would say I agree. I believe that LeBron James probably should win MVP, and maybe circumstances dictate he won't because, like, maybe he gets injured or something or just has a drastically bad year. But LeBron James should have won MVP last season. He was clearly the most valuable player. He put up his best season, mind you, at age like 32 or 33, and he lost because Russell Westbrook was a stat stuffer. So he didn't even get into the top three. Kawhi Leonard, who can really do two things. He can defend and he can score a little bit. LeBron James is better than Kawhi Leonard at everything, and his statistics were much better than Kawhi Leonard's at everything. Kawhi Leonard didn't register a game where he had more than 7 assists until, I think, the playoffs. And that's his career. He'd never had a game with 7 or more assists. And I think a couple of days after I heard that stat, he had a game where he had 7 or 8 assists. And I can't remember if it was either late in the season or in the playoffs. So Kawhi Leonard had his status elevated just because he plays on a good team in the Spurs. Whereas LeBron James, the media is basically going through what I would call LeBron fatigue, or, you know, whoever fatigue. Michael Jordan experienced the same thing in the sense that he didn't win MVP every year when he probably should have for most of his career. So, who do I think will win MVP? What is interesting, because LeBron James has a much better chance this year than he did last year, because Russell Westbrook and James Harden are both pairing up with superstars that'll decrease their stats, which will make the media less enamored with them. Kawhi Leonard has a pretty good chance because he didn't pair up with anybody. Forever alone. But you know, LeBron James, he's going to be in the top there. Kawhi Leonard will probably be up there with him. And it'll probably end up being a race between those two with the potential dark horse of Giannis Antetokounmpo, who we will be discussing in a moment. But, you know, I think LeBron James should win this. And so technically I agree with this, that LeBron James, I would agree with the 50% of GMs that LeBron James should win MVP. But I don't think he will, because again, the media, it's not that they won't recognize his greatness. They'll say, yeah, he's the best player. But they'll hand the award to somebody else because it's a better story. It's a better story to hand the award to the guy who got 42 triple-doubles than the guy who is clearly the best player. The MVP award never goes, or it doesn't go to the best player because he's the best player. It goes to the player with the best story who put up the best stats, if that makes any sense at all. It's always the story. Like Derrick Rose. He won the MVP because everyone fell in love with Derrick Rose. LeBron James had better stats in every single category, except I think assists. Actually, he might have had more assists. LeBron James was superior in basically every way to Derrick Rose, but Derrick Rose won the MVP because everybody loved Derrick Rose. So let's move on to the next one. We're going to really get into a rant here. If you thought I ranted about LeBron James, get ready for this. So this is the question that was asked. If you were to start a franchise today and could sign any player in the NBA, who would it be? In the first slot, it was Karl-Anthony Towns, 29%. Giannis Antetokounmpo with 21%. LeBron James at 18%. Kawhi Leonard at 14%. Kevin Durant at 11%. Now, this isn't a who's the best player, because obviously the top two, they're very young players, and that's what they're thinking. They're thinking, I'm going to start a franchise with a really young player. That way I can get 15 years instead of LeBron, who will be lucky to play maybe another 9 years. And that's really stretching. He's only got an effective 4 years left, I believe, at his current pace. But here's the thing. I don't get why people keep falling head over heels for these incoming star big men. Because Karl-Anthony Towns is basically just warmed-up leftovers of Anthony Davis. Now, mind you, it's warmed-up leftovers of a $200 steak. But still, Karl-Anthony Towns is not exactly a generational talent. And again, I can understand why people love him. Because at just 21 years old, here's what he's done. And I'm trying not to downgrade this. But at, again, 21 years old, he scored 25 points per game. 12.3 rebounds per game. He had 2.7 assists per game, 1.3 blocks per game, shot 54% from the field, and 36, almost 37% from three-point range. That is spectacular for a 21-year-old. You do not see that every day, and he will be one of the best players in the NBA. He has the potential to be top 10. But here's the thing I don't get. How many teams win championships with a center, or power forward for that matter, as their best player? And I'll say LeBron James. LeBron James is not a true power forward. I'm talking a big man. The 6'10", 250-pound, back-to-the-basket, with some stretching-the-floor ability. Like, that's that kind of power forward or center. The last person I can think of is Dirk Nowitzki. And before then, who knows? Basically, every championship team wins because they have great wings or point guards, specifically shooting guards and small forwards. Those are the players that win you championships. So when people keep saying, I want to build my team around Karl-Anthony Towns, why? Yeah, he's a great player. I'd love him to be the second best player on my team or tied for the first. But if he's my best player and clearly my best player, I might be looking at my options to potentially trade him and get somebody else. Because look at this. So Kevin Love, when he was 22, played in Minnesota like Karl-Anthony Towns is. He put up 20 points per game, 15 rebounds, 2.5 assists. He only had 0.4 blocks, shot only 47%, but he shot 41% from three-point range. So he's putting up great numbers himself when he was also young, playing for a crappy team. Anthony Davis, the guy who I said Towns basically warmed up leftovers for. At 21, Davis put up 24.5 points, just over 10 rebounds, two assists a game, nearly three blocks. He had 1.5 steals per game. Shot 53.5% from the field. He was a bit of a stretch four, but he didn't shoot threes. I think his three-point percentage was like 8%, but he didn't shoot really any threes. So he just missed like however many he took, except maybe made one. Now, with these three players, Karl-Anthony Towns, Kevin Love, and Anthony Davis, if we're excluding Kevin Love's time in Cleveland, they have a combined one playoff experience in all their years. In all of Kevin Love's years, and all of Anthony Davis's years, and in the few short years of Karl-Anthony Towns, they have one playoff appearance between them and zero playoff wins. Anthony Davis, I believe it was 2014-15, was swept in the playoffs. Sure, he was great, but he's not helping his team win championships. And you can talk about their teammates, but Karl-Anthony Towns has Andrew Wiggins, he had Zach LaVine, Ricky Rubio, who's solid. Now he's got Jimmy Butler and Jeff Teague. They're still not going to win that many games, I don't think. They're not going to be as good as everyone thinks because they still have young players. And you just don't win games when your best player is your center. The only reason the Timberwolves might make the playoffs this year is because Jimmy Butler is going to be their best player, and he's a small forward slash shooting guard. He's a wing player. So when people keep saying, well, I want Karl-Anthony Towns is my next good player, I say, good luck to you. I'll take the second guy on that list and whip your butt in the finals. Actually, you won't make it to the finals, but I will. Giannis Antetokounmpo, the guy whose name I say differently every time I say it, and I nearly spelled correctly when I wrote it in my notes. I was only two letters off. I switched a couple letters around and forgot an N that's in there. I would take Giannis Antetokounmpo over Karl-Anthony Towns 11 times out of 10. Because this, again, glossing over the fact that small forwards and shooting guards, if you can call Giannis a small forward or shooting guard, they usually win championships. They carry their teams. Giannis, this last year at age 22, put up just under 23 points, just under 9 rebounds, 5.5 assists, 1.6 steals, 1.9 blocks, 52% from the field, 27.2 from three-point range. So not very good, but he's been improving every year for the last 3 years. And Giannis has the potential to be a better version of Kevin Durant. In terms of Durant, he's longer, more athletic, quicker, already a better rebounder, already a better passer. And mind you, he's a lot younger than Durant. And when people say that he can play every position, they are not exaggerating. He can literally play every decision. With no exaggerations there, you could start him at every single position. And he can play both ways. No other player in the NBA can do that besides LeBron James. And LeBron James would be slightly too short to play center. He can get away with it for a while. But some guys might take advantage of him in the low post in terms of height. Not necessarily size or strength. So, why people want Karl-Anthony Towns, I get why they like him. Great stats, great potential, could be the best center in the NBA in the future. Although we're going to get to that in a moment, in terms of best centers. But I would take Giannis Antetokounmpo 10 times, 11 times out of 10, over Karl-Anthony Towns. Because Giannis is going to be a superstar, and Karl-Anthony Towns is just going to be a star. He'll be a great player. He'll be an all-star, a perennial all-star. He'll probably make the all-star. He might. The West is kind of stacked. But he'll probably make the all-star game. But Giannis is going to be a star for years to come, provided something doesn't catastrophically change his career. But next, we're going to get to the best centers in the NBA and what was kind of a travesty. So, the NBA, or the NBA GMs, voted on who they thought was the best center in the league. And first was Karl-Anthony Towns. Second was Anthony Davis. Now, mind you, Anthony Davis was voted the best power forward in the NBA, so already you're seeing some inconsistency. I view Anthony Davis as much more of a power forward than a center. He's not quite bulky enough to play center, although that's not really a thing anymore. So Anthony Davis at number two, Mark Gasol at number three, DeMarcus Cousins at number four. Now, mind you, and also Draymond Green got a vote for best center. Draymond Green definitely plays power forward and only plays spot center minutes. He's not a center. He's a power forward. So Rudy Gobert was voted second team All-NBA as a center. He was behind Anthony Davis, who, mind you, is still a power forward and played power forward next to DeMarcus Cousins, who came in at fourth. So it's weird to see that people consider Anthony Davis a better center than the guy who starts at center instead of him. But Rudy Gobert, second team All-NBA, really should have been first team, is essentially fifth in voting. And I don't understand how that is. Now, well, I guess I do understand how that is. It's based on reputation, especially Mark Gasol. Mark Gasol is past his prime. And sure, he's still contributing to his team. But let's look at Mark Gasol and DeMarcus Cousins. Gasol and Cousins combined for 15.3 win shares last year. Rudy Gobert, by himself, had 14.3. So essentially, the combined might of Mark Gasol and DeMarcus Cousins is one win better than the singular Rudy Gobert. And how both of these guys ended up in front of Rudy Gobert is beyond me. It just doesn't make any sense. And Rudy Gobert led the league in blocks, was the biggest defensive disruptor in the interior in the NBA. He was clearly the best interior defender. People had to game plan around his interior defense. Sure, you can argue maybe Draymond Green's a better overall defender. Kawhi Leonard's obviously a better perimeter defender. Rudy Gobert's not guarding anybody on the perimeter. But Rudy Gobert changed offenses once they got inside the key. Everyone is scared of Rudy Gobert. And on offense, at one point, he was at the top of the league. He didn't finish this way, but at one point, he was at the top of the league in offensive and defensive rating. So maybe he's not putting up the flashy 20 points per game. He's only putting up like 12 or 14, I think is what he finished with. Maybe he's not putting up all these points per game, but he was extremely efficient in doing so. When he had the ball in scoring position, he scored. And he didn't take a ton of possessions or a ton of shots to do so. So he was offensively more efficient than any of the guys in front of him, though perhaps not as productive. Well, not as productive, I'll just say that. But he's better defensively than all of them and had a more positive impact on his team than any of those. And even on offense, he was a really good screener. He led the league in the stat they call screen assists. So offensively and defensively, he holds his own offensively and is clearly the best defensively, yet he's the fifth best center? That is just something that baffles me, that people would be so completely ignorant. And yes, I'm a Jazz fan. There is some enormous bias here. But that is a travesty. Rudy Gobert should not be considered the fifth best center in the league, and all the GMs should know it. Their coaches probably looked at this and thought, yeah, my GM's an idiot. Rudy Gobert is clearly better than DeMarcus Cousins. I worry more about Rudy Gobert than DeMarcus Cousins or Marc Gasol, and perhaps more than Anthony Davis or Carl Anthony Towns, depending on which side of the ball you're on. Brad Stevens game-planned against Rudy Gobert in the playoffs. In the regular season, they didn't play in the playoffs. There's only one game I was thinking of. But Brad Stevens, when Boston played the Jazz in the regular season last year, game-planned defensively around Rudy Gobert. He tried to keep Rudy Gobert out of the offense, and they won the game. They didn't game-plan against Gordon Hayward or George Hill, the two leading scorers for the Jazz. They game-planned around Rudy Gobert on offense, like when Rudy Gobert was on offense. That was their defensive game plan, was to keep Rudy Gobert out of the offense. Which tells you supposedly Brad Stevens is a really smart coach. Okay. He thinks Rudy Gobert's a threat on offense. So that's all my rant about the NBA GMs, and that's going to wrap it up for Talk the Walk this week. We went a little longer. I wanted to give you all more substance. We've had some shorter episodes. And frankly, there's a lot to talk about. So again, thanks for listening. Wherever you're listening to this, on Podbean or YouTube or wherever I've managed to post it, thanks for listening. We'll talk to you later. You're going to walk it, talk and talk to walk. You're going to